Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to News Roast. My name's Julian Rubinstein.
My name is Hayden Prowse.
Hayden Prowse with a little bit of a cold
today.
Did
a little bit of sniff there.
A little bit of a sniffles.
And we'll explain why I have the sniffles.
We will
in one
indeed.
Of our courses. Let's not jump the gun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, this is not Miami flu or anything like that. There's been no late nights. This is because we have been at really the center, the apex of capitalism,
of capitalism.
We just returned from some extraordinary filming that you will see later this year in Davos, which is the playground for 3 days of the super rich, the oligarchy, political leaders from around the world, and also technological innovators for the World Economic Forum.
That's right, and Donald Trump.
Oh, and Donald Trump.
And whilst we were there, we picked up a stray journalist.
We did.
Was sort of wandering down, bumbling down the street.
Yes.
And we took him into the warmth.
Yes, exactly.
And out of pity more than anything else, we decided to invite him onto
our
podcast.
Definitely out of pity rather than his sheer brilliance.
Not the fact that he's an incredibly interesting man who we were immediately fascinated by, and we asked him on.
In all seriousness, we are absolutely over the moon to be joined by the editor of Wiki Tribune, Peter Bale. Welcome to News Roast.
Thanks very much, Julian.
So for people who may not be familiar with Peter's work, Peter was the CEO for the Centre of Public Integrity and Investigative Journalism, which is a non-profit in Washington, D.C. Now, the CPI, which recently incorporated the International Consortium Vicious of Journalists. In fact, let me just say that properly.
The ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is best known for having done the Panama Papers.
Indeed, the Panama Papers, which Peter oversaw. And Peter joined the CPM from CNN International, where as vice president and general manager, he worked for some time, also worked his way around Microsoft, and has basically been at the forefront of technological innovation through news platforms as they developed, be that MSN, be that CNN, and now Wiki Tribune. So, Peter, before we go too much into your career, for people who don't know what Wiki Tribune is, what is it?
So Wiki Tribune is a concept, really, that is founded by Jimmy Wales, the guy who created Wikipedia 16 years ago, which is now the fifth largest site in the world. And Jimmy has a strong belief that he can improve the quality of journalism, improve the trust in journalism, and really resolve the business model difficulties of journalism about clickbait and about the business model being very much driven by click generation and click-related advertising. He wants to redo the business model in the same way as he did for Wikipedia. The difference is we have about a dozen professional journalists, or theoretically professional journalists, creating content every day, and that's the sort of catalytic content which at the moment we want the audience, the community, to react to. And we launched 2 months ago. The idea is that the community will eventually supplant, in terms of volume, the amount of content that the professional journalists are creating.
Mm. So this sounds maybe a bit like I'm being deliberately obtuse, but the tagline of Wiki Tribune is evidence-based journalism.
That's right.
So why don't you explain to people what that means?
Well, the principle is we make no assertions, we make no claims, or try to make no assertions and try to make no claims that we can't stand up. The sourcing is deliberately very thorough. You should be able to drill down into the story to find out exactly where we got the information from the originating source. You should never be lost for words, lost for understanding how we got to that point, why we got to that point. And really, the community is a participant in that. They are theoretically holding us to account. So if I make an assertion, as I did in a story the other day, that Justin Trudeau had, quote, lectured the audience at Davos, I really thought twice about that phrase. Can I justify that? I believed I could. Other people may feel that's a little bit too much, too liberal with my descriptions. But that's the point, is that the audience will hold us to account transparently, and we theoretically will hold ourselves to account in order to really demonstrate that we've thought about trying to get to a neutral or objective point of view.
So it's sort of immediately peer reviewed.
It is. Funny enough, you should say that. It's very perceptive, Hayden. I think of it as peer reviewed journalism. And in a sense, so Jimmy's vision is that the community is an unequal, the community members are on an equal footing as the professional journalists, and so that does mean peer-reviewed journalism. And if you think about it, most journalism out there at the moment is very much, I won't say throwing it against the wall and seeing what sticks, but there are some very big, often very sweeping statements that are not always backed up and very well thought about. It's too easy to be glib. Even in an environment where fact-checking is promoted.
So it's like Wikipedia.
It's like Wikipedia in the sense that it's community-driven.
Yeah. So it's there Wikipedia for news, is it?
Yeah.
You could call it that, but very separate from Wikipedia. The only connection between the two organisations is Jimmy. There is another product called Wikinews on Wikipedia.
Right.
It doesn't have the same power behind it, if you like, or the force behind it of a dozen reasonably experienced journalists, or very experienced, i.e. old in my case.
So Wikinews would be more citizen journalism, and yours would be still some citizen journalism, but with a bit more of an editorial sort of guiding force.
That's correct. Ours is based in the UK, so therefore everything is going through an editor. Everything is going through an editing process because of British libel and defamation law, which is not conducive to just throwing everything against a wall and seeing what sticks. And so there's a professional standard behind it, and an attempt, at least a wish, that we maintain very high levels of editorial quality, whether it's from our own people or from the community.
Okay, so if for our audience, if they haven't checked it out, this is at www.wikitribune.com.
That's correct.
And please register.
It's a great idea, isn't it? One of the big issues of our time is obviously fake news, and how better to combat fake news than to have an army of online fact checkers checking what it is, the stuff
that
you put out.
That is the ambition. You'll go to the site and you'll see that we're still calling it a pilot. It is not finished yet.
It's a huge endeavor.
It's a huge endeavor, and we're experimenting every day and on everything that we do. So, we're constantly being held to account by that community and by that audience. And we're trying to learn every day. It is not a finished product by any means yet.
It's fascinating, and thank you so much for telling us a bit about it.
It's sort of like a practical version of every time I pick up the mail, I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, come on. That is fucking bullshit. It's like a practical version of that.
It's almost exactly that.
Where you can actually change the text in front of your very eyes.
That's absolutely correct. Right. Yeah.
It's just like that.
And funny you should use those words exactly as well, because we've had some interesting discussions lately, and I have decided, and hopefully the community agrees with me, we will use words like that if they've been used in quotes. There will be no *...*.
So just before we get into your courses, you were obviously in charge of one of the biggest political leaks in history.
Yes, the biggest.
So just talk us through how the Panama Papers came to be, and also just the release of those.
Yeah, well, let me be clear. The Panama Papers is very much the work of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and the staff, and of course, Süddeutsche Zeitung, which was the German newspaper to whom it was leaked. The key issue of trust there was the leaker, whoever that was, deciding that he or she could trust the two German newspaper people from Süddeutsche Zeitung. They then had a separate moment of trust, having worked with the ICIJ on two other very big investigations, one called Swiss Leaks and another about Luxembourg, about leaks in Luxembourg, about banking secrecy. And those two German newspaper journalists knew that the best way that they could get global trustworthy coverage of that, or the ability to take that, I think it was 2.5 terabytes of content, and process it, analyze it, make it available to nearly 1,000 other journalists to work on simultaneously for a year, was to do so through the ICIJ's network. And that's where the respect and pride must lie in the ICIJ, in the fact that they had established this extraordinary network, which allowed them, both from an engineering point of view and a trust point of view, to have nearly 1,000 journalists working on this content without it leaking for a full year until the moment in April when we were ready to go with it, in April 2006.
It is quite extraordinary.
2016.
We digress. So that was very interesting. Again, I would strongly recommend, if you are listening to this, to check out, Wiki Tribune.
I'm super excited about that. Yeah. I think that's going to change. I mean, that's
a
game changer.
It's completely free to access, free to register to, and if you register it, you can edit, you can create, you can comment, you can do the Oxford commas, you can fix my spelling, you can fix it to English and then back out of American spelling, you can do what you like.
Excellent. let's move on to your metaphorical starter, Peter.
So the metaphorical starter is trust.
Ooh.
Because it starts, you know, everything starts from trust. If we don't have trust between the three of us, we can't really have a decent conversation. Or we end up being, you know, English people and skeptical about everybody at the time and not looking at each other in the eyes. And trust is at the center of some of the things we're going to have for the main course, I think, and possibly even dessert. And we have a trouble. We have a problem with trust at the moment, which is that, you know, trust in the media, trust in what I publish, trust in the work that I've been doing all my life, is at an all-time low. And that's, you know, depressing to me. I also help run a journalistic industry group called the Global Editors Network. It's worrying to us. How do we bring that trust back? How do we work? I mean, not that it was necessarily always there. People have been right to be skeptical about journalists. You know, since the 1890s, you've had yellow journalism in the UK, if you like. You've had pamphleteers. You know, we're going through another era where the equivalent of the pamphleteers can publish anything they like, and it'll stick, particularly on social media. But how do we bring, you know, so my issue with this is how do we encourage people to be able to have a certain amount of faith in what they're reading and a certain amount of respect in it, and good faith.
Before we go on to why we are, I mean, what the remedy is, for maybe some of our listeners who listen to this podcast to really get a grip of some of these issues, what's your perspective on why we have arrived here, and break it down for us in terms of particularly the British media landscape, which you obviously know very, very well?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and it's both, just let me be clear also that, you know, I will speak as the launch editor of Wicked Tribune about Wicked Tribune, but I'm also going to speak in my own capacity, possibly as the president of the Global Editors Network, but really for myself. So, you know, some of the opinions that I'm going to express are really mine and not those of the publication.
You're just the guy called Peter speaking.
That's
your
exactly
truth.
Right. That's exactly right.
Hashtag blessed.
Doing my best, exactly. But I think the dodgy dossier and going to Iraq was phenomenally damaging for the perception of public trust and the trust in institutions in the UK. So there's that. You know, it was the manipulation of the media by the media itself in that particular case as well.
By Alistair Campbell particularly?
I know Alistair pretty well. I used to work with him in the 90s. I think Alistair was doing Tony Blair's bidding and doing his best to, as I think Richard Dearlove, I think it was, or maybe Scarlett said at the time, that the facts were being assembled to match the story
and
at the time.
And completely exonerated.
I don't think they've really been completely exonerated. If you look at what happened in the various reports on it, I think exonerated is way too strong a term. I would say that some people acted in what they believed to be the best interests at the time, but there were phenomenal lies, there were phenomenal untruths, there were people pilloried. You know, I'm thinking of Professor Kelly. You know, and I think some of the people involved profoundly regret that. But I think that was a moment where public trust was dented very seriously and for all the right reasons. And I think there have been two other huge moments in the last few years that apply to this, and that this is particularly about Britain. And one is the Hackingate, the discovery that the amount of surveillance, the amount of dicking around with people's mobile phone calls that was going on there for not a single story that mattered. Had it been a story about why we were going into austerity, or what was the real deal between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, or why did we go to Iraq? But it wasn't. It was who's fucking whom. And then, of course, it got even worse because it then became about Millie Dowler. And whatever you say, maybe there was some misreporting or misrepresentation of the way The Guardian represented that, because there are people in News Corporation or News Limited who will say, you know, The Guardian destroyed the News of the World. And I think that's bollocks. The ethics of the News of the World destroyed the News of the World. And the trouble is, I am a very libertarian person when it comes to freedom of speech. But, you know, I would have loved it if there was even one story in that whole Hackingate period that mattered, and it was all crap. People were selling their journalistic souls, selling their ethics. And this is the other thing about it, is the profound cynicism. There's a wonderful book about The Sun called Stick It Up Your Punter. You know, it's the profound cynicism that sits under some of these gigantic publications, whether that's the Daily Mail or the Sun at times, and that really eats away at public trust in journalism. I think the other thing, and this is more global and it fits in with the Davos conversation, is the 2008 financial crisis and the cleaning up of that, and the fact that you know, basically nobody in the UK or the United States or who's middle class or below has had a pay increase for a decade, and the lack of trust, the lack of transparency in the way that was handled. I think those three factors of Iraq, the global financial crisis, and Hackingate have really eaten away at the fabric of trust.
Those three things were so seminal. You're totally right. And it is that lack of trust that I think has given us Brexit, has given us Trump, and has made the arguments of whatever you want to call it, I guess, the sort of liberal elite, has made their arguments so fundamentally ineffective and so without any substance.
Putting aside Trump for a moment, I think that's absolutely true of Brexit. Yeah. I think Brexit was a vote of lack of trust in the establishment.
Yeah.
You know, you've got David Cameron, sort of a weird combination of Teflon and oil. Personally, I think Steve Bell was really cruel and unfair to just to portray George Osborne as a gimp all that time.
Yeah.
But there is something sort of vampire-like. And so you've got this thing of austerity pumping away. And then you've got David Cameron saying a simple in and out vote. And then you got to the essence, which Michael Gove said, of I think the people of this country have had enough of experts. And I think they had. And I think they were sending a message that had virtually nothing to do with Europe and nothing to do with the EU, except that let's not forget that Boris Johnson, Daily Telegraph correspondent in Brussels, you know, 20 years ago when I worked with him in various EU conferences, we've had a relentless beat of the EU as a bunch of faceless bureaucrats. The EU's not in our interests. What about the Spitfires? You know, we were alone in Dunkirk. This Dunkirk bullshit. You know, my father fought for the Royal Air Force. He was a New Zealander, but he fought in the Royal Air Force. You know, he said, when are the British going to get over the Second World War? And I noticed the German ambassador said that this week, that we're still infected with this 1945, you know, guns of Navarone bullshit.
Well,
and it
has actually
had a tremendous effect on this debate.
An incredible quote that I wanted to read today that Robert Peston actually put out. And he said, at the World Economic Forum in Davos last week, Angela Merkel naughtily poked fun at Theresa May in a secret briefing for journalists. Here's what transpired according to those there. Merkel said that when she asked Mrs. May what she wants in the shape of UK relationships with the EU, Mrs. May said, make me an offer. To which Mrs. Merkel said, but you're leaving. We don't have to make you an offer. Come on, what do you want? To which Mrs. May replied, make me an offer. And so, according to Mrs. Merkel, the two find themselves trapped in a recurring loop of what do you want and make me an offer. At its telling, the hacks laughed uproariously, though I'm not sure this is so funny for the UK.
I found this actually, and I'm you know, I'm apolitical. I do my best to be apolitical. I don't tell people how I vote or even if I vote. But I was really struck listening to Angela Merkel and Macron in their speeches, you know, their speeches the other day, how much more authentic, how much more intelligent they came across than Theresa May. Not that she's not intelligent and probably somewhere in her life authentic, but it was just a speech of complete emptiness. And then you say this deal thing, make me an offer. This is where we're getting into this kind of transactional politics that Donald Trump is talking. Everything is a deal. Everything is a deal. It's crap. Everything is actually about relationships, and it's about morality. It's about honesty, and it's about shared interests.
So what is your next topic, Peter?
Well, I thought once we dealt with trust, we'd look at Davos itself. I want to be very, very clear that, you know, Davos is a club where you look in, you know, it's much better to be inside than tapping on the glass on the outside or behind the velvet rope wanting to get through. So, you know, I'm not going to crap all over it, but I think there are some very interesting things. And as you said, it's an irony-free zone, and there's nothing that that cannot be parodied to a good extent.
Well, we didn't actually, we weren't surprisingly enough allowed in. We just literally were tapping on the glass outside. So, I mean, What was your perspective on this?
This relates to the trust thing, because I was there and it hit me. This trust thing is so important. It hit me as soon as I arrived. In fact, as we flew into Zurich, lines of private jets on the runway. You know, you come out of the airport, there's lines of sort of blackened out window Mercedes Benz is quite sinister. You get up, you know, 5,000 feet up this mountain. You know, there's a ring of steel. There's 5,000 troops there. There's basically, I would imagine, 98% of the world's wealth is represented within that tiny town, as well as every single political decision maker that's got any clout.
Correct.
And all they're talking about is equality. And you're like, something's fucking wrong here. What is going on? If all of these people, there's either a lack of inclination to solve this issue, like either they're really, you know, they just don't want to, or they're really shit and don't have any power and don't have any money.
Yeah,
they clearly have a lot of money and a lot of power, so it's got to be the
Let's
the
unpick
former.
A couple of things you said, though, which are slightly unfair.
Okay.
So, security. We have a responsibility to look after our politicians. You know, the United States has had Ronald Reagan shot in the middle of Washington at the Hilton. It's lost JFK. They have a responsibility, no matter whether it's Donald Trump or someone somewhat more appealing,
so
to protect them.
Okay, so let's not let them get killed.
But we just, let's just think, the security is there. It's incredibly important. We have a responsibility to look after our political leaders. They're elected there. So all this stuff about whether it's expensive to follow him to Mar-a-Lago and stuff, I think is irrelevant. Okay. He deserves, as the president, the same level of protection that anybody else has, as does Macron, as does Trudeau, as does all these people. So I think, you know, this the security one is always an interesting story. Yeah. But those poor buggers who are trying to protect those people, you know, deserve some credit. There is a we'll get to it, but there is a convergence of interests amongst those people, which I find extremely interesting. And there is value in it. And there's also things we need to be incredibly skeptical about it. There are things we need to absolutely take the piss out of. Mm. And then there are things we need to sort of think carefully about whether it's actually good to bring them together in one place in a secure environment from time to time that they can actually have a conversation with each other.
But to what extent is this narrative about equality that they're all banging about window dressing?
Okay, no, it's not window dressing at all. And I think it's the people who are banging on about inequality is essentially the politicians. Mm. And it's the most sensible of those politicians. It's Angela Merkel, it's Trudeau, and it's Macron. Because they know that the rise of populism, whether it's driving Trump or whether it's driving Brexit or it's driving the AfD, and is because of inequality.
Yeah.
And I personally think that a lot of this is because we failed to deal with some of the issues in 2008 of the global financial crisis. So it was able to look like and be a bailout of the bankers and appear like a bailout of the bankers, as opposed to a sensible strategy to support the financial system, which in my view, possibly people much more intelligent than me, should have also been matched by some sort of Keynesian investment in infrastructure. You know, none of us have particularly seen any real benefit from the 2008 financial bailout, other than the collapse of our banks and the collapse of our pension funds and this kind of thing. But we haven't seen the sort of corresponding. We had an incredible low interest rate environment in which we have failed to invest in infrastructure. So we haven't seen the common person has not seen the benefits from this.
Been, it's been far more drastic for quote unquote the common person than that, because I'm sure we're at a stage, you know, certainly in economic terms, where we're all paying tax. We are, you know, sort of medium to high earners. But if you rely if you rely on the state, then actually the situation has been epically disastrous. You know, austerity in reality has been cuts systematically made to all of the public sector's infrastructure, whether it's welfare, healthcare, the police, the fire service, and then selling off, not just in a piecemeal way, but in a very direct way, the most valuable aspects of that.
Let's specifically think about the UK. So we're talking about Davos, which is the world, the Western world, plus China, plus I can say the Soviet Union, which we'll get to in a minute, but Russia. But it's certainly in the UK, the push for austerity has landed on the people who are least able to deal with it, and it has led to the mass suppression of wage growth, you know, right across the board, but particularly in the public sector. And I think you're right. That has, you know, left us with some really serious consequences of poorly delivered public services, poorly reformed public services. I mean, I think everybody would argue, we would probably, if you talked probably to Gordon Brown now and Alistair Darling and Robin Cook, if he was still alive, they would probably say, I think, that the reform of the education system and the reform of the National Health Service was unfinished business from the Labour government. After the money went into it, there wasn't really the reform on the delivery of it. And that's something that Jeremy Hunt has been trying to do, except that their natural instinct is to reform it by bringing in the private sector, which is arguably not necessarily a brilliant idea.
So how did you find it, actually? You know, you got through security in Davos. And just to say, so people kind of understand, like, you know, you're walking around, Google have bought out a shop front, you know, Facebook have got another one. All the countries have kind of, you know, Ukraine house, Russia house, where you're walking, equalities house, and you're hearing these, some quite fascinating talks. But yeah, you walked in there. You'd never been there before. What's it like? Like, walk us through it.
Well, there's a promenade. There's the amusing aspect of it is this promenade, which is kind of a Rodeo Drive of capitalism or Westfield of capitalism. Mm. And then every now and then, and it's not just when I say capitalism, you're walking down there and it's Microsoft and it's Google and it's Facebook. Mm. But then all of a sudden it's Palantir, which is a search company that specializes in security search. They are the people who evaluate every telephone call made in the United States and look for matches in it. And there's all of the accounting firms. There's the people who provide offshore services. There's the insurance companies. Everybody's there, the health companies. They're all in this kind of promenade of capitalism. And then every 10th or 5th one is some sort of philanthropic group just sprinkled in there to make sure that you're not, you know, completely overwhelmed. And of course, what the philanthropic groups are after is the sort of, to me, Davos is really about three things: money, power and redemption.
Fascinating.
You know, power, what do powerful people want? What do politicians want, ultimately? Mm. Money. What do money people want, ultimately?
Power.
Power.
Yeah.
And then what do they all want? Redemption.
Oh,
so you get the money, you know, you've got the money factor in there, which is the gigantic corporations, particularly the banks and the finance companies that are if private equity companies that are hugely represented there, like BlackRock, you know, these companies, Blackstone and BlackRock, that are the biggest companies in the world doing their business. Citibank, HSBC, all of those. And then you've got the politicians who are, you know, selling access to themselves in a sense for business because they've all been... You know, the key foundation of Davos is the concept of the stakeholder economy, which I think people probably remember that Blair was probably the first person, first prime minister here to really pitch this.
And just effect, explain it to our listeners if they might not understand.
So there's a guy called Klaus Schwab who founded the World Economic Forum, born in 1938 in Germany. So he really has that kind of post-war German mentality of let's not do this again, you know, emerging from something. Better that we all talk, better that we talk big ideas. One of his personal big ideas is the stakeholder economy, the idea that we're all connected, whether I'm a supplier, an employer, a consumer, a shareholder, an owner of the company, or a politician, we're intimately connected. And that's the kind of interconnected fabric that ties the people in Davos together. And I think we've got to decide, or there will be two sides of this. One will say this is a symbiotic relationship, and other people will say that's a conspiracy.
So we got to move on shortly, but I'm really fascinated because you were there. Obviously, people on the left are horrified by Donald Trump's brazen, what some people describe as almost masochistic, you know, misogyny and racism and the like.
He didn't display any misogyny
well,
and racism
this is exactly
in,
what I'm saying.
In his Davos speech.
So, isn't he?
The economy is booming. These facts are, you know, I was, again, looking at the fact that Chevrolet are coming back from Mexico, coming back and putting in $350 billion. What was his speech like and how was it received?
His speech was received very politely. I've had to face some criticism from people saying, why were we talking about Trump so much? The entire place was just on edge, wondering what on earth he might say. Because the point is he goes off. You know, he tweets, even if he gives a 20-minute straight up and down speech straight off a teleprompter, which is what he did, he can then alarm everybody with a tweet that follows and it shows the real him. This time he showed the real him with a sort of off-the-cuff comment at the end of it about the media saying, oh, and I can see the televisions being sent off, being turned off, and of course they weren't. And I had no idea how nasty the press were when I was a real estate guy, you know, or how fake they were. And that led to some minor hissing and booing in the crowd. But really, for the rest of it, he stuck to his speech. It was a very, very well-crafted speech, very important that he didn't frighten anybody, and it was a very transactional, very Donald Trump speech. Buy America, come to America, invest in America.
It felt a little bit like he was the boy that got invited to the club that he'd, you know, he'd always been excluded from. Because he's a billionaire and he's never been to Davos before. And these are the New York elite that kind of shunned him a little bit.
The only one that I know of his sort of circle who has been there a lot is this guy, Anthony Scaramucci.
Yeah.
And there are some absolutely hilarious stories being written about his wine tastings of, you know, $500,000 bottles of wine and just how obnoxious they were. And so, I think there is something of that. You know, we see in Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, we just see how desperate he is for the craving of acceptance. Yeah. And he loves the acceptance from billionaires.
It's good we come on to Michael Wolff because just to say, so obviously we had met Peter before, sort of full disclosure here, and we had spoken about the fact that Michael Wolff's actually a personal friend of yours.
Yeah, I don't say that to too many people. Certainly not if you're going to broadcast this.
Well, you told us.
Because he's not allowed to have friends.
Right, he's not allowed to have friends. Obviously, that book, obviously, according to Donald Trump, is all fake news, absolutely ridiculous. Now, to people who've read it, like me, it is one of the most, I mean, I wouldn't say it's like full of revelations. It's one of the most fascinating soap operas I have ever come across. What sort of reaction has it had in the professional press, this book? Do you think it's going to make a difference? People have said they think it's going to unhinge him, unseat him.
Oh, I don't think it's going to unseat him, and I don't think it's going to unseat him, but it is the truth to an extent. I mean, it is. There's been tremendous snobbery in the journalistic establishment, what Michael calls the church of journalism, about this, because it doesn't say, you know, 16:35 on a Tuesday, I spoke to the president for 2 minutes and, you know, here's my recording. That's the kind of thing that we do at Wicker Tribune. We're doing evidence-based journalism. Michael is trying to do the sweep of the story. You know, he's much more like Truman Capote or Tom Wolfe. Wow. He's giving you the sweep of a story. It is not a piece of forensic reporting.
No.
It is a piece of forensic recollection of what a lot of people around Trump have said and what the president himself has said to Michael.
My problem with it isn't that, and I've read bits of it, I haven't read all of it, but is that it's not, it just falls into the same, you know, trap that most sort of journalism and most comment has fallen into during this Trump era, which is attacking him on for sort of cultural criticism rather than, you know, economic criticism. And that cultural argument has been won. You know, you turn on any sort of news show, any, you know, comment show, like whether it's The Late Show or The Daily Show, and they're all just like laying into Donald Trump day after day, and it's having no impact.
I think this is a really serious problem. I don't agree that that's what Michael's done, because I think if you look in that book, what it's telling you is that there is a sort of circle of quasi-grown-ups around him who simply do not know how to handle this man-child in the middle of it. And that's a little bit different from saying
that every so often he crushes one.
That's right. But I do think it's absolutely correct that whether it's the New York Times or the Washington Post or Saturday Night Live, I mean, not to mingle those three things together, but there is too much shrill screaming, worry, fear out there. And I think one of the, going back to the first course with the about trust is I think one of the fundamental problems we have in journalism at the moment is the merging of comment and analysis with reporting. It is very hard for a consumer of news to work out, is this a genuine piece of reporting or is this a piece of opinion? And the merge between, in fact, you know, this is the issue that the editor of the Wall Street Journal, Jerry Baker, has had a lot of criticism over, because he's trying to make sure that the news in the newspaper is the news and commentary is commentary. And I totally support his trying to make a difference between those two things.
Moving on to your dessert.
That was a very good main course, though, wasn't it?
That was lovely.
I feel satisfied.
Yeah, thanks.
But in a kind of like non-sort of...
What did we actually have?
Fatty, gluten-free way.
I feel like I could have some biscuits and cream for dessert.
Ooh, some biscuits.
I mean, it's related. All these issues are very sort of fundamentally related. But what have you brought us for your metaphorical dessert?
My metaphorical dessert was going to be about Russia. But I think there's also some, you know, there's a few bits and pieces, maybe some grapes from the previous course that might come across.
I think
across.
So. I mean, they're the kings of fake news, really, aren't they? They're sort of kings of misinformation and sort of obscuring the truth in sort of
they are, and that of course is a Soviet era.
Yeah,
you know, when you don't have the First Amendment, when you don't have freedom of the press, which of course we have no statutory freedom of the press in the UK either, you can get away with some fantastically well constructed lies, and where people feel as though they prefer the lie to the truth. I mean, a friend of mine, David Satter, has written a couple of the best books about Russia. And he's used wonderful Russian proverbs as the titles, and they are, "It was a long time ago and it never happened anyway," which is a brilliant book about in his view, how until Russia comes to grips with the Gulag and the Stalinist period, that it will never be able to mature as a democracy. And his other one, more recent one, which is about Putin, is "The less you know, the better you'll sleep." And the point of that is that, you know, people just close their eyes to this. You know, this is Vladimir Putin is a person who, with the KGB and the FSB and whichever they were called at that time, you know, presided over, probably it would appear, the blowing up of apartment blocks to be blamed on the Chechens, you know, with people in them.
To justify war.
To justify war and to trigger war. You know, this is somebody who is utterly cynical. And I think this issue goes to something we should have dealt with in the trust session, which is moral equivalence. If you remember, Donald Trump said, when asked about dealing with Putin, he said, "You think we haven't killed people too?" And that is one of the scariest things I've ever heard any world leader, particularly from the United States, say.
Because
Because it's putting us morally equivalent to somebody who is essentially a dictator and somebody who was a former spy, a former KGB man who works and applies those methods.
So what is the difference between us meddling with Iran and installing the Shah there, which led to the Iranian Revolution?
Well, it was 19...
With the Iran-Contra scandal. Yep. What is the difference with all the messing around with South America and Central America for the last 30 years?
That was 1953, was the overthrow of Mossadegh. So that was 8 years after the Second World War. We've come a long way since then. The interference in Iran-Contra was under Reagan, you know, and Oliver North.
And yet Saddam and regime change post 9/11 was...
Absolutely.
You just mentioned the dodgy dossier.
Sure, so. But don't forget, in the first Gulf War, we had an alliance of Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, all the Gulf states fighting on the same side
As
the United States, it was a proper UN-led agreement.
But a lot of people would argue.
The first Gulf War.
A lot of people will argue that actually the real reason that that war even took place was because America was finally able to put military bases in the place of the two holy cities, Saudi Arabia and Mecca and Medina, mm-hmm. after the Crown Prince had basically said to Osama bin Laden, "You cannot bring the Mujahideen from Afghanistan to fight a secular leader." There's a fair amount of evidence to suggest that even then we were really looking at the projection of global power by the dominant country in the
true,
world.
True, but don't
the
forget
United
the protection
States.
Of global power is partly about interests. You don't project global power to places you don't have interests.
Guys, what both of you sound like right now is like a couple that have been married for like 10 years that are like, yeah, but last Tuesday
you said
intentionally left my dinner in the oven. It's like when everyone's behaving badly, it really doesn't matter whether it was 5 years ago or 20 years ago, what you did. If you're all behaving so badly, it doesn't really matter because the criticism that Russia can level at us and the United States is all based in fact. Mm. So there's not really much we can say.
But look, do look at Russia, though, for some investigative journalism that brings that out.
Well, Peter,
I wanted
to ask you, as soon as I saw that you wanted to talk about Russia, because mm-hmm. you are very well versed in this, to tell our audience and myself a little bit, particularly about Alexei Navalny, mm-hmm. who, if you haven't heard of it, is by all accounts extremely popular in Russia and is potentially the man who one day may unseat Putin. Now, if you follow, as I do, Bill Browder on Twitter, who James O'Brien, we're a big fan of James O'Brien, he in his Unfiltered podcast talked to this man. He tweeted a video of this man being basically beaten to the pulp by Russian defense forces, security forces, Jesus. At his own mm-hmm. Rally. So if you have never heard of this man, who is he? And could he help save Russia?
I think it's extremely unlikely that Alexei Navalny will survive long enough, in a sense, politically, to actually replace Putin. But he is the last person standing, if you like, who is genuinely offering political alternatives or political difference. You know, you've got, you know, Putin has pushed aside, killed, or arranged to be killed, or otherwise eliminated or bought off any potential alternative, whether it's the oligarchs. He pushed Boris Berezovsky out of the country, potentially. You know, Boris Berezovsky died of a heart attack here, supposedly. You know, people don't survive very long when they go up against Vladimir Putin. If you read some of the books that I've described, along with another woman, Karen Deweish's book, The Putin's Kleptocracy, which the Cambridge University Press declined to publish in this country because it was regarded as too much of a defamation risk, you'll see that the death of Alexander Litvinenko through polonium was no accident and is not, you know, well, sorry, we know it's no accident, but it was by no means the first. So, you know, Navalny is nobody is perfect in this environment. Nobody's perfect in the post-Soviet environment. Nobody's perfectly clean. But you know, they've tried everything with him. Usually you go through the tax system, then you go through you try and have them set up with some sort of psychological problem, or you have them set up to be out with prostitutes or something like that. He's had everything thrown at them. You know, bankruptcy. You can't stand in the Russian elections in March if you've been convicted of a federal offense. He's been convicted of a federal offense very conveniently, which prevents him standing in March. It's all about giving Putin a clear runway. And of course, Putin has also created a kind of fake candidate as well to give the impression of a choice. But there is no choice. There is only Putin.
Interesting.
Peter, we could go on talking to you for years.
And probably will. And
I very much hope that we can have you back on News Roast, because I think it's certainly very rare for us to have someone with the level of acumen and experience that you do in journalism. Just for people who may not have been aware of WikiTribune, of your work, what's your handle on Twitter?
At Peter Bale, P-E-T-E-R-B-A-L-E.
Okay, and Wiki Tribune, is that something that is a crowdfunding platform?
We are crowded by funding. We are crowdfunded, and that is the way Jimmy wants it at the moment. We're not taking advertising at all.
So how do people do
People can
that?
Come to the site, wikitribune.com, and click on the top right-hand side where it says support us. But first, click on the one that says register, and come and register, participate in it, and then see if you want to support us. We'd be really delighted to see you there. And tell me, please, that you've come from News Roast so that I can give these guys a gigantic kickback.
Well, Peter Bell, thank you so much for coming on the show. And hopefully we'll get to see you soon.
Thanks very much, boys.
Thanks.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.